This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the Black is Back Coalition gathers community input for a Black People's National Political Agenda, one that includes Black community control of the police. And the two-party system looks like it's coming apart on both the Republican and the Democratic sides of the duopoly.
Half of this summer's political drama will play out in Philadelphia, where the Democrats are holding their national convention. Bill Clinton launched into a political tirade earlier this month when activists from the Philly Coalition for Real Justice denounced the former president's mass black incarceration and anti-poor people policies. Bill Clinton ranted and raved for 13 minutes and then issued a backhanded non-apology the next morning. We asked Megan Malachi, spokesperson for the Philly Coalition for Real Justice, if they were surprised at the venomousness of Clinton's response.
No, I don't think so. I think that anyone who would propose the 1994 crime bill that Clinton was responsible for, I don't think that you could be surprised at the way he reacted. I think that Clinton has tried to do a good job over the last few years, kind of backtracking and doing these strange apologies that really, you know, don't help the people who have actually been incarcerated. So I think that he was really angry to be called out in this particular space. He went to an area of Philadelphia that is black, bourgeois, and middle class, and I feel like he thought that he was going to be safe there. And when he discovered that he wasn't, I think that is another thing that triggered that reaction, which, you know, once again reveals what we've already known about Bill Clinton, that, you know, he is a racist white man who had no problem putting millions of black people in prison.
It seemed that in the course of the demonstration and his response, some of the folks who'd come to see him sounded like they were on your side.
There were a few people who voiced their support for some of the things that we were saying. But in general, the crowd was quite antagonistic. When Erica and Rufus started to chant, they responded with HRC. And they also screamed loudly in favor of Bill Clinton trying to take Rufus and Erica to task. So, you know, in general, we still see people who don't seem to understand who the Clintons truly are and what the consequences have been for that 1994 crime bill and also the Welfare Reform Act that you mentioned before.
That lack of an understanding of who the Clintons really are seems to be rather pervasive in the black community. Clinton's still picking up the majority of primary votes among black folks.
Yes, that's definitely true. And I was listening to another report, I believe on NPR, and one of the journalists kind of posited this generational split between young black people and older black people, which is kind of funny because Erica is 38. And Rufus, I believe, is 32, and I'm 34, I'll be 35 next month. And so all of us are old enough to remember what the world looked like during the time that Bill Clinton was president. And I don't recall this, you know, amazing time for black people that people are saying that the older generation black people are reminiscent of. What I do remember is, you know, drugs in my community. And I also remember black people being taken to jail for non-violent offenses. So I remember those things being extremely pervasive. I don't remember all of this economic recovery that people seem to talk about as a reason for why black people are supportive of Bill Clinton.
The U.S. pattern seems to be that even when there are grassroots movements and a popular upsurge in protest, all that goes by the wayside every 4 years when there's a presidential campaign. I guess you guys are trying to make this one different.
Yes, you know, honestly, as a coalition, we have not and will not endorse in candidates, because we fundamentally believe that electoral politics will not liberate the black or poor communities of this country. But we definitely want to take the politicians to task for their part in constantly and consistently betraying the aspirations of poor people. And, you know, even though so many people in Philly last week were so happy and seemed to be so invigorated by Bernie Sanders' candidacy for president, to us this just seems as another distraction, another cop-out from people to truly get into the streets and demand justice for all the things that we, all the ways that is that we've been oppressed, whether we're talking economically, whether we're referring to police terrorism. You know, we don't think that that electoral politics is going to free us from those, you know, extremely pervasive forms of oppression. We think that getting in the streets, we think that organizing our communities in Philly, that is what is truly going to liberate us.
Yes, you're calling for self-organization of black and other oppressed communities. And you just came back from an action in support of two of your members who were recently arrested.
There were actually three of our members, Erica and Rufus, were arrested, and also another one of our comrades, Kamal. They were arrested for protesting in front of Fox News, a very popular newly elected mayor, Jim Kinney, ran on the promise that he was going to end stop and frisk and also use this promise to appeal to black voters. And it's not even 6 months, and he has already gone back on that promise along with the support of the Philadelphia Police Department, as well as the newly elected police commissioner, Rick Ross. And so we're not wasting any time. We want to expose these dastardly events to our community and show them that no matter how many times we vote, no matter how engaged we are in the political process, what really matters is what we are going to do for ourselves to protect ourselves.
Well, the Democratic Party is coming to your city big time this summer. It's going to be the site of the Democratic National Convention. What's going to be going on in the streets during that time?
We definitely have communities that are planning to have their voices heard, quite similarly to how things were with the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party back in the 50s. I think that we're experiencing a different time, but we plan to truly make the DNC an event that will not be forgotten. And we plan to, of course, hold these people accountable. And we plan to also hold black elected officials accountable, the misleaders who continue to betray us. They come for our votes every 4 or every 6 years. And so we're going to be talking about all of those things at the DNC.
Your coalition is taking credit for helping force the resignation of the ex-police commissioner, Charles Ramsey. Charles Ramsey was the co-chair of President Obama's presidential task force on policing. What's that say about Obama and his task forces?
It speaks to Obama's role as a black gatekeeper, as one of the, you know, very insidious black misleaders that we have. Someone who claims to help the black community, but actually has joined with one of the worst of America's commissioners. We're quite clear that before he came to Philly, he's responsible for the abuse and the oppression of the black community there, and specifically activists who protested and won judgments against the city under Charles Ramsey's tenure. And so he came here to Philadelphia and did the same thing. And yes, he do take responsibility for his ousting when he supported, along with Seth Williams, the police murder of Brandon Tate Brown. We held him accountable with the promise that we will be everywhere you are. And the one of the last times we saw Charles Ramsey, we were running him into the bathroom at Eastern State Prison, where he hid from the people because he was so ashamed.
And what about black Philadelphia Democrats, that is, those who are active in the party in Philadelphia? Well, how do they feel about your coalition?
Quite frankly, we don't care how they feel, but I assume that they aren't happy. I think they're the type of black people who would tell us that we're not doing things the correct way. That seems to be a very common refrain that we hear, but that's really not what we're concerned about. We are concerned about dealing with the black and oppressed people who face the brunt of the betrayal that our black elected leaders constantly make us face. And that's what we're focused on. We're not focused on the feelings of any black politicians, particularly the ones who consistently do things that stand against the people's aspirations.
I remember 50 years ago, we were told that we needed to take the movement from the streets into the suites. What good did that advice do us as a people?
I don't think it's done us much good at all. I think it's done individual black people and possibly elements of the middle class, the black middle class, it is. They've done them some good. But in terms of the black masses, the black underclass, we're continuing to suffer. And part of that is because we trusted those black misleaders to represent us, and they have not. They have failed us.
Lots been said about, in fact, you made reference to it earlier in this conversation, a new worldview or a different worldview coming from a younger generation. Is that really true? And what does it mean in terms of black political formations in the future?
No, and I think that's one of the problems, of course, with mainstream media and also the lack of political education in some aspects of our community. But I always feel like there's been elders who believe the same things that we are stating currently. Here in Philly, we have Dr. Anthony Montero, we have Tam and Ramona Africa, and they've always stood right along with us in promoting a radical black tradition of protest and of anti-racism, anti-oppressive politics. And so I don't necessarily think that what we are saying is new, but what I would like to see with our generation is that we truly hold other elements of our community who talk about representing us accountable. And of course, our older generations have tried to do that, but we just want to do that work well, and we want to win. We are the real Philly Coalition for Real Justice, and while we're definitely in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement, our political line is Black liberation, and we are specifically fighting for the aspirations of the poor and working classes here in Philadelphia.
That was Megan Malachi of the Philly Coalition for Real Justice.
Dr. Anthony Montero is a Du Boisian scholar and veteran activist who was one of the founders of the Black Radical Organizing Committee, which held a national conference on the Black Radical tradition earlier this year. We asked Dr. Montero what kind of reception Black Philadelphia will give the Democrats when they hold their national convention in July.
Well, I think, first of all, we're going to have the primary here on April 26th, a week after New York's Democratic primary. Now, this is going to be huge because what I think we're looking at is a drawing of battle lines, and it is, in essence, Hillary Clinton versus the people and the people's movement. And I am convinced that black people in Philadelphia will break with the black misleadership class, which are on Hillary's side almost to a man and woman, will break with that and express their opposition, not only with Hillary and her corporate 1% backers and her war plans, but they will renounce and reject the black misleadership class. Now, we already saw something of that when two protesters, by the way, two of them were arrested yesterday in a civil disobedience action. But these two people confronted Bill Clinton at a meeting of about 200 political activists who were being organized to get out the black vote for Hillary. And these protesters shut him down. I think it has had a great impact upon the consciousness of ordinary black people. So I think, you know, April 26th is going to be huge, but it will lay the basis for what will come in July when progressive and revolutionary and radical forces from all around the country will be here in Philadelphia. And they will be here to attack Hillary, the 1%, the 0.1% that run the Democratic Party and who have distorted even liberal bourgeois democracy to the extent that we can't even recognize it as democracy. It is a plutocracy run by a oligarchy, and I think the people are awakening, and it's going to be a party for the people, a celebration for power of the people in July.
You seem to be saying that this great upsurge in black grassroots political activity isn't just directed against big white corporate institutions like Temple University, but that what we're seeing is an internal kind of struggle within the black community.
That's right. And let me tell you something, Glenn. It's going on in community organizations. It's going on in churches, even churches where ministers have brought Hillary in to their congregations. There are divisions. And it's going to be interesting whether or not these preachers are going to be able to parade her into their pulpits on Sunday morning before the primary, or whether or not they're going to have to be more cautious. I'm of the opinion that there are going to be places where these ministers are going to have to be more discreet because their congregations are not accepting Hillary Clinton. And, you know, one of the great ironies is the fact that black women are more anti-Hillary in this primary season than black men are. And that's anecdotal. But, you know, it's one of these contradictions, these ambiguities, where black women have not forgotten the way that Hillary went after Barack Obama in 2008. And they still harbor distaste and dislike, even contempt for Hillary Clinton. And you know, the black church is pretty much run by black women. So these preachers are going to have a difficult time trying to bring her into their pulpits. I think that the internal struggle against the black misleadership class in academia, in the government, in the electoral political system, in the unions, in the churches, that struggle has now reached a critical moment. And so we have both the struggle against the external enemy and the internal collaborators.
That's Dr. Montero. In that analysis, you didn't mention the name Bernie Sanders. What does the presence of his campaign, what's the relationship between that and this emergent black grassroots movement?
He is kind of the voice of this movement. And as this movement becomes angrier, as it becomes clearer in who the enemy is, you see Bernie Sanders becoming angrier, more intense in his critique and attack upon Hillary Clinton and the corporate elite. You know, a big part of this, and I think this could be significant in the election, but going forward in the way that the trade union movement reorganized itself, this Verizon strike of over 40,000 workers around the country. And this strike is now becoming something of a political strike because Bernie Sanders has offered his political capital and his support to the Verizon workers against the Verizon corporate executives. And the CEO of Verizon has attacked Bernie, and Bernie attacked back, which is very, very good. Now, the other thing is the 60,000, I think it is that, but I could be wrong, Transport Workers Union that is based in New York, the local in New York in particular, has come out supporting Bernie Sanders. This is very significant, not only for the struggle against Hillary Clinton, establishing, again, the battle lines of Hillary Clinton and the 1% versus the people now galvanizing and organizing around the candidacy of Bernie Sanders. But going forward, this will be significant in the fight against the misleadership class within the trade union movement, within the American Federation of Teachers, within AFSCME, within 1199C. So it's all of these struggles that will decide in a lot of ways whether or not the people will have a fighting leadership that reflects their interests and the need to fight for what they need, or whether it will continue to be this collaborationist, bootlicking, bowing down leadership that is as corrupt as those who run the Democratic Party.
Well, is there room for such a fight in this duopoly kind of system? Are we talking just about a Hillary versus Sanders and Cruz versus Trump, or is the duopoly system here at stake in this election season?
Yes. You know, what we see is political turmoil. I, like you, will predict, and I don't think I'm going out too far on a limb here, that we are in the beginnings of the collapse and unraveling of the two parties. It's clear that neither Trump or Sanders are invested in the ongoing existence of these two parties. I think that we are about to see a new political moment in the building of a new political party, not unlike the formation of the Republican Party out of the Whig Party, but I think something way more significant, because this occurs at the same time of a huge systemic crisis. And what is going here is reflected all over the world, in South Africa, in Indonesia, in South Korea, and throughout Europe. So this is a global movement, a worldwide movement. It is assisted by the World Wide Web, the Internet, and social media. And, you know, it's a great crisis of legitimacy of the global 1%. Something new is occurring, and this will go on after the November election. The November election, I think, is just a moment in a longer and more profound process of radical transformation economically and politically, and for this country, within the belly of the beast.
Yes, what does the crisis in the duopoly system mean in terms of this emergent black movement? After all, there is no group that is more loyal to the duopoly, to the Democratic Party, than the established black Democratic leadership.
Yeah, and you know, we have to remember that that is only about a 25-year process. It took all of this time and the candidacy of Barack Obama to kind of seal this deal, this bargain with the devil, this Faustian deal with the Democratic Party. But I think it is more fragile than any of us thought, because we'll see in New York in the primary next Tuesday. We'll see, I'm certain, here in Philadelphia. We've seen inklings of it in Michigan and Ohio and Missouri and Illinois. But I think we're going to see a almost complete break with that cozy relationship. And it will lead to new leadership coming forward, anti-Democratic Party, anti-1%, anti-neoliberal capitalist leadership coming from the people. I'm confident of that. And it's like, you know, if you got a horse waiting to get out of the barn and run loose, run wild. And that's where the masses are right now.
We've seen the Black Lives Matter Network and some of the activist organizations in Philadelphia swearing off endorsement of any of the candidates.
Well, that's true. But see, at the same time, Black Lives Matter, the Black Lives Matter Network, is only a part of the mass movement of black people. Really, you got to look at the working poor and the working class as a whole among black people to really see the force that will upset and render impotent the bargain between the black community and the corporate 1% that runs the Democratic Party. I think that black people are not going to sit on the sidelines in this political struggle between Hillary Clinton and people. They're not going to sit on the sidelines, nor are they going to follow those who say that, well, we can't do any better than Hillary Clinton. You know, their argument was that, well, Hillary Clinton is the only one that can beat Donald Trump. Now the polls are showing that Bernie Sanders beats him even by a larger margin. So that argument they no longer have. So the issue is now not the lesser of two evils between Hillary and Trump, but the real economic need of the people. And that's what black people are going to vote on. And they're not going to stand on the sidelines. It's not a matter of endorsement or non-endorsement. It is a matter of the fact that this is a great battle that, for many reasons, historically and otherwise, is now situated within the Democratic Party and within the two-party duopoly. And that's where the struggle right now is centered. And to advance it against people like Clinton, it is necessary as a stage to freeing black people to play their historic role, the role that you and others at Black Agenda Report have decried our inability, our ineffectiveness over these last 8 years. I think we're looking now at the fact that black people are going to break loose from that. We will once again become the vanguard of the struggle for peace and social justice and human rights. We will be the vanguard of the oppositional forces. And when I say we, I'm talking about the working class, the poor, the unemployed, the young people who have no future, those who are in prison. We will play our historic role. And to play that role, we have to defeat, at least make our voices heard in the defeat of Hillary Clinton.
Dr. Anthony Montero, speaking from Philadelphia.
St. Mary's Church in New York's Harlem was packed this month for a national conference on the 2016 elections and black self-determination. The event was organized by the Black Is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations. Coalition Chairman Omali Yeshitela said the electoral process is not the only means of struggle. In fact, it's not even the most important means of political struggle.
For those who value electoral politics, it is worth noting that it was not electoral politics that won Africans the right to vote in the United States. It was the independent struggle by African people across the ideological spectrum that won that concession from a brutal white power that brutalized and murdered Africans as part of the resistance to this simple democratic right to vote in a system rigged against our success. Several of the members' organizations of the coalition have participated in electoral politics, including this writer, myself, and our party. And the coalition endorsed the successful candidacy of a former leader of the provisional government of the Republic of New Africa, Chokwe Lumumba, for mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. Our coalition also endorsed the candidacy of Ron Gochez of the Mexican National Liberation Organization, Union de Barrio, for a position on the city council in Los Angeles, California, at that 2014 National Coalition Conference in Newark. The Black Is Back Coalition intends to move our general struggle forward by initiating an independent national black agenda for self-determination. This is where we're going. We have to move forward toward the initiation of an independent national black agenda for self-determination. This is something that our steering committee has already voted on. We haven't voted on exactly how this thing should look, but that's what we've said. The Black Is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparation will use this conference today on the 2016 election, the struggle for self-determination, as part of a process culminating with our traditional November rally, march on the White House, and national conference, where we will unveil our own agenda created independently of the participation and wishes of either of the bourgeois political parties and or institutions. So between today and November 5th and 6th, which is when our rally march on the White House, and national conference will occur. We will begin the process of forging, under the leadership of the coalition, assemblies throughout the United States where African people can come together. We will create our own independent national black agenda that we will unveil in November. This is the direction. We don't give a damn who gets elected or what gets elected. The thing is that we're going to hit the ground running with our own agenda, and that's the critical thing that has to happen. So it is our responsibility to determine the path of our struggle. The critical issues affecting us cannot be left to the wishes and interests of any other group. We can and must demand reparations, regardless of Sanders, Clinton, Obama, Trump, or any other representative of white power. Our national black agenda for self-determination must include this invaluable and just demand. Our agenda must demand the release of all Africans being held in the concentration camp of the United States called prisons. And especially our beloved political prisoners who have sacrificed everything for the emancipation of our people. Our agenda will doubtlessly decry any taxation of African people by the United States government and any of its agencies. I unite with Ron Isley and Wesley Snipes and whatever Wesley sister's name. We don't owe them a damn thing. In fact, it's our money, and we want it now. I assume we will also demand the immediate withdrawal of all colonial occupation police military forces from our community and their replacement by black community control of the police. Black community control of the police. Proportionate representation within all the current existing government authorities, including electoral position, is something that some are demanding within our communities. An end to the brutish removal of Africans from our communities, usually referred to as gentrification. And look at what they're doing right here in our Harlem. It is ridiculous. Community control of our schools and education, etc. These are just some of the likely demands that will be included in an independent national black agenda for self-determination. And it has to also say something about what they're doing with housing projects throughout this country, that they're turning them into places for just African women and children. These worthless, horrible punishment that they call welfare, that requires that there can be no African men in the houses and stuff like that as a condition. They require disunity of our community as a condition of getting pennies from this government. So, I mean, these are issues that I think that our agenda should reflect. And we will not neglect Africa and the host of other imperialist military occupation must end, and reparations to Africa for the loss of life and resources that include the black bodies forcibly dispersed across the earth must become a part of our agenda. Down with AFRICOM. Down with the U.S. military bases throughout the continent of Africa. Out, out, out. They all have to go. We have to deal with this issue of immigration. Here, white people leave Europe hungry and starving. Come to a land and steal it from a people who are thriving. Take the land, push them into concentration camps that are now referred to as Indian Reservation. Come to our Africa, attack Africa, kidnap us, bring us here and disperse us around the world. Then steal half of Mexico, and they're the only legal people in the damn country. We have no respect for that at all. We have no respect for a situation where they talk about legal and illegal immigrants, where an African cannot even get to this country, can't get a visa out of Africa, can't get a visa in any other place. They steal and extort their money, have them standing in lines all day in the hot sun, take money that's worth 2 or 3 months salary from them, and then deny them the right to come to this country. They're saying that the only Africans who can come to this country have to come in chains, be slaves. And we say, hell no, that doesn't work. Anyway, open up the borders. Open the damn borders. Let everybody in. So, We say it is also likely that we will demand the immediate cessation of U.S. support for the white nationalist settler state of Israel and a transparent process of negotiation with the indigenous peoples of the U.S., victims of genocidal terror and land expropriation and annexation. Our agenda will most likely unite with the Mexican people who are spoken of so disparagingly by all bourgeois parties and candidates. Every one of them speaks. I don't care. They don't have a good line on the Mexican. Well, we'll let them in. We have guest workers. Guest workers, hell, you, if anybody should be the damn guest, it's their land. And you're going to let them come in as guests. Somebody come in and rob you, steal your house, and then kick you out and then tell you you can come in as a guest. Hell no. We unite with the Mexican people. It's their land. We recognize that half of Mexico was taken by gunpoint from the Mexican people and an artificial border created that separates the people from their own resources and from each other and that facilitates the wealth of the white ruling class and whites in general. Our agenda will be able to unite with the popular declaration of the Mexican people, quote, "We didn't cross the border crossed us." At our November 5th and 6th rally, march on the White House and National Conference, the coalition will unveil the People's National Black Agenda for Self-Determination. With this agenda, our own, we begin the process of charting our own course. We free ourselves from the political whims of white power and all of its agencies and reestablish our legitimacy as an oppressed people determined to be free on our own terms. With this approach, we can win. We will win. We are winning. Black self-determination now. Uhuru.
That was Black is Back Coalition Chairman Omali Yeshetela. Diop Olagbala is an African Socialist Party activist based in Philadelphia. He spoke on one of the Black is Back Coalition's principal demands, Black community control of the police.
The people are ready to struggle for the power. The people are ready, as they have clearly shown in Ferguson. In fact, some of the first chants that came out of the Ferguson struggle in response to Mike Brown's murder was not hands up, don't shoot. It was kill the police. CNN reported on that. But opportunists intervened since then and took the struggle, took the consciousness in a whole other direction that we'll talk about soon. So why we say black community control the police? Because the fact is that hands up, don't shoot, don't work. Black Lives Matter is an empty slogan that disarms African people from the ability to really deal with the issue. Remember, the Malcolm X grassroots movement came out with this report in which it was stated that an African was killed every 28 hours. Fast forward to 2015, approximately 557 Africans killed. So that's an increase of about 130 more Africans. The point is that it's clearly been an increase, intensification of repression of African people since the Ferguson rebellions, since Baltimore. So how does that add up? Because we know that when we resist, when we stand up, the imperialist state falls down. However, resistance in itself is not enough if it is not tied to revolutionary strategic aims. Hands up, don't shoot didn't come with no demand. So even though the people rose up and was willing to march and all that, we was marching to give more power to the pigs. And they used that power very clearly in the fact that 150 more Africans got killed in 1 year since the times of Trayvon Martin. But the point is that marching, demonstrating, protesting is extremely important. But if it's separated from revolutionary program, an anti-imperialist program, if it's separated from strategic goals and demands, then it can be used against us, as we've clearly. And in fact, the masses can become demoralized by the fact that we out here marching and all that, but the pigs is killing us even more. And the only thing that really changed is the fact that some of these opportunists get to be on TV more or may have the opportunity to get some kind of opportunity, you know? So reformism and opportunism have left the masses defenseless, and we have to say that. In that camp, we put Black Lives Matter. We put the so-called campaign to stop and frisk, body cameras, Obama's disingenuous criticism of the U.S. prison system, If you can say that there's something wrong with the prison system, then why you can't free African people from these prisons? You know what I mean? If you can say it's something wrong with the prisons, then why you, you know, if it's, yeah, so, but all these reformist demands, especially if they separate it from the strategic demand for power, all that does is reinforce and it improves imperialism's capacity to oppress our people and keep things the same old way. So we have to be very clear about that. You know, and Asada said it very well. Nobody in the world, nobody in history has ever got their freedom by appealing to the moral sense of the people who are oppressing them. White power oppresses us based on their material interest to do so. To the slave master, the slave's lives matter. That's why, because when they first started slavery in places like Barbados, they would work an African until he died, period. They would work you until you died, and then they would just go get another one from the continent until they realized that that was not the most profitable way to extract our labor and resources. Then they started feeding you and keeping you alive so you can make more babies. So, you know, black lives do matter, you know, to the one that's exploiting black labor. That's not enough. When we have to bring that kind of science to the people. So we say black community control of the police means power. It's not a candidate. It's not a religion. It's not a hairstyle. It's not a feeling. You know, all these things can and will be used in certain kinds of ways. Maybe not all of them. But the point is that it's about power. It's about concrete, measurable types of ways to achieve the power. So what do we mean when we say power? You know, somebody, in I think it was in the 60s, they came out with the phrase, power is the ability to define a phenomenon and make it act according to your will. And I think that's a pretty good definition. So when we say power in this instance, we're talking about the ability for the black community, collectively, the democratic masses, to define who and what the police are in our community and to make it act according to our will. Concretely, that means based on the documents that you have in your packet, one, we want a black community control of police commission that would be elected by the African Democratic majority, workers, students, youth, women. And this commission would be responsible for overseeing the activity of the community. But this commission is accountable to the people because the people voted on them based on an election that we control, based on standards that we define. So also, black community control of police means power to hire and fire the police in our community based on their conduct, based on, And the police conduct should be monitored by the community itself through neighborhood and block-based organization. You know, if the pigs acting up on your block, this should be an apparatus, just like right now how the Democratic Party got these block captains every Thanksgiving to give out turkeys and keep the rest of the money for themselves. Well, we're talking about flipping that around where we have block captains that would be responsible in part for the people have somebody to go to say, I had this problem with the pigs, and that would be, you know, taking down the organizational chain of command or whatever. There will be a process established, but the point is there will be a way to hold the police accountable on every block, neighborhood, and section of the city that you live in. Black community control of the police means the power to subpoena through judicial forces accountable to the Black Community Control of Police Commission and the community with skills and knowledge of case necessary to facilitate the judicial process. Now, I know it sounds like I'm talking about lawyers and all that, but I'm not necessarily. When we talk about skills and knowledge of the case, I'm talking about who was there. Who was there? Who saw what happened? You know what I mean? What works for the people? You see what I'm saying? Not based on some static, mechanical law that's been developed by the same ones that have an interest in our oppression. Also, black community control of the police means power to train and set standards of procedure. We say anybody in the community with a gun should be obedient to the African community. And when we say obedience, we mean they carry out the policies that have been developed and defined by the African community. This is just a proposal. It hasn't been established or nothing like that by the coalition. But I have seen and experienced and been part of processes where revolutionary national democratic programs have been literally constructed by the people in meetings like these. People come with the ideas in terms of what the program should include. We want this. We want that. And there's no reason why we cannot construct a program that would define the policy of the police inside the African community. We can hold meetings just like that one to establish that kind of thing. And these are the types of, and we're calling on forces that's out there in the world today. We're saying that everybody needs to hold up the strategic demand for black community control of the police. We want to popularize the demand. We want to make it something that everybody embraces and takes out in 1,000 different ways. We also saying that the struggle should not be isolated to any sphere of activity. We're saying all the way from the ballot, all the way to the bullet. And it has been stated before in terms of elections and how we can use the electoral process to advance the strategic demand for African community control of the police. So it must be said that these young Africans in particular out here, I'm going to call on everybody to be a part of the Black Community Control of the Police working group. So you can do so. Just holler at me after the workshop is over.
That was Diop Alugbala. Our own Nellie Bailey, co-host of Black Agenda Radio, addressed the Black is Back Coalition National Conference. Bailey's a veteran Harlem Tenants organizer. She spoke on the demand for Black self-determination and the centrality of the housing issue.
Housing activists in the Black radical tradition are engaged in class warfare with finance capital for living space. It is a global struggle for the most basic human right, and that is the right of shelter that is enshrined in the United Nations Charter. The late Neil Smith, a distinguished professor of anthropology and a geographer, he was a friend of mine. He worked before his death. He was at the Graduate Center of New York City. Now, he has a very different take on the conventional wisdom or of gentrification, that it is a matter of white people moving in. They want a more chic neighborhood. Yeah, that's really true, but it is a much more simplistic analysis of what is really happening here in terms of the market forces that are at work. Neil Smith presented gentrification as part of a much larger shift in the political, economic, and culture of the late 20th century. He documented the conflicts that gentrification brings to the new urban frontier, because if any of you read anything on Harlem that used to be described as a marginalized community, quickly it earned the name of the new frontier, as if this was some backward settlement and the whites would encircle Harlem to bring about civilization, so to speak. So Neil Smith's definition of gentrification was right on target. But you see, it goes much more than that. And let's go back to the 1970s here in New York. And there's a great book by Roderick and Deborah Wallace. And it was their 1998 book, A Plague on Our Houses, that indicted New York City's establishment, its plutocracy, its oligarchy, for the drastic cuts and municipal services so as to run down Harlem to contribute to its physical deterioration, which is what they did in the Bronx. And this policy that came under Abe Beame, former Mayor Abe Beame in the 70s, was a policy called Plan Shrinkage. And this was a plan that was cooked up in the RAND Corporation, which is the think tank for the government. Well, plan shrinkage meant that you withdrew municipal services from blighted communities because they could not support the tax base. That's why the Bronx burned, and it was not because of the people of the Bronx, but it was the landlords who were setting fire to their buildings because of the insurance. And the engine, the growth engine of New York City is fire, finance, insurance, and real estate. And that's why the Bronx was burning and burned down
as it was. Now, they had a problem here in Harlem. They couldn't burn it down. It's in Manhattan. It's not isolated like the South Bronx. So they had to do something else. So they began to let the landlord slide, who milked the building of their profits until the last. And then they would abandon these buildings. New York City, during the 70s, ended up owning 60% of the housing stock. Just think about it. 60% of the housing stock. And under this progressive gentrification with Obama and white face Bill de Blasio, most of those properties are being turned back. Now, Roger Starr was the housing czar at the time. Really quite a character. And what Roger Starr said as he implemented planned shrinkage, he said, and I'm paraphrasing him, but I think you will get the drift of this. He said, blacks and Latinos should leave the city. This is no longer an industrial economy that can support them. They need to leave the city so that we can get on with the business of building a wealthy enclave that is here today. And I thought that was really very curious, because planned shrinkage was really a policy to disperse Harlemites, to disperse blacks and Latinos from New York City. That's what it was. That's what it was. But you see, this public policy has been around for a long time. There was a young activist. Her name was Yolanda Ward, and she lived and worked in Philadelphia and in D.C. And she talked about spatial deconcentration. And spatial deconcentration came as a result of the urban rebellions. Johnson was president at the time, and he established the Kerner Commission. And what they were concerned about is the fact that these urban rebellions were a threat to national security. So how do you contain this threat? What do you do? How do you contain it? They went, of course, to the Rand Corporation. And we have to remember at that time, at the Kerner Commission report that came out that talked about two separate society and all of that, this was weeks before the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King that happened on April 4th, 1968. And so with this explosion all around them that was so great that the House Un-American Activities Committee was trying to pressure Lyndon Johnson to declare martial law. But Johnson refused. But they had another plan because they knew they had to do something. So the Kerner Commission was established. And based on their recommendation, other organizations came out of that. But it's important to look at the conclusions of the Kerner Commission. And what they talked about in spatial deconcentration was a dispersal of underprivileged, marginalized, code word, black people from the inner cities. That's what they were talking about. So this young woman, Yolanda Ward, said it's very clear. Because remember, I started off talking about Roger Starr, who, with planned shrinkage, concluded that, in fact, this dispersal policy would drive blacks and Latinos out of the city and they would be rid of them. And that has continued today. Now, in the Kerner Commission, what is so important was the number of police officers and the military personnel that was involved in setting up and drawing up the recommendations for this. So, in short, I want to say, we are not paranoid. It is real. It is public policy entwined with market forces, venture capital, disaster capitalism to take back the cities. This dispersal policy has been around since the early 70s, and it's not going anywhere. And whether or not it is Bill de Blasio, who is the most egregious fake politician on the level of Barack Obama that one never wants to set eyes on, we have to be on our guard, and we have to understand, as has been repeated here over and over again, the Democratic Party is not an answer. It's not an answer to political power, to our housing needs, to our health needs, to none of our needs. And if we're talking about housing, without housing, you can't even begin to think about control of the police, because where are you going to live? And we have to link these issues in a single movement, as the Black is Back Coalition is doing. But we have to build this national movement that is a broad tent that will bring in progressive forces. That's what we need. Marxists and whomever, as long as they are progressive forces, and we have principles of unity and which we can all subscribe to, because opportunism and sectarianism will destroy any movement, as we have seen over and over and over again. And the FBI and the CIA have not gone anywhere. I dare say they are even present in this room. So we have to be vigilant. We have to be courageous, but to know and to say and to repeat and to assert, Black power matters. That is our mantra. Thank you.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.